Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The Athletic.
In the words of Eric Ten Hag, Sir Bobby Charlton was a giant of Manchester United, and I'm not even sure that did him justice. He served the football club for nearly 60 years as a player, a director, and an ambassador. He is a symbol of Manchester United. His grace, his talent, and his courage transcended sport, leading the football club from the disaster of the Munich air crash to the glory of the European Cup, winning a World Cup for England and a Ballon d'Or, and countless club honours along the way as well. He made 758 appearances for United, scoring 249 goals. He won 106 caps for England, scoring 49 goals. He was the benchmark for United and England players, an inspiration, a great player, and an even greater man who will never be forgotten. Thank you, Sir Bobby. This is Talk of the Devils, the Athletic's podcast dedicated to Manchester United. On this episode, we're going to pay tribute to the great man and share our memories of him as well, and our heartfelt sympathies go out to his wife, Lady Norma, his family, and all those who loved him. Andy Mitten and Laurie Whitwell are with us. Andy, what would you like to say at this point? Very sad news.
Very sad. Huge story in the UK, around the world, reflecting the status of the man. One of the greatest, maybe even the greatest English player ever. The man for whom Old Trafford's main stand is rightly named after. 758 appearances, as you said. Growing up, I never thought that would be broken, nor his goal-scoring record for Manchester United. European Footballer of the Year in 1966, ahead of Eusebio, ahead of Franz Beckenbauer, but second and third in 67 and 68 as well, so consistent. And the fact that he lost some of his closest friends on the airfield in Munich and survived physically, if not mentally, because he wore them mental scars until the day he died. He thought about them boys every single day. He said that several times. To then be such an integral part of Manchester United's recovery and rise, he's one of the best players in the 63 Cup final against Leicester, which was United's first trophy after Munich. A star of the 65 and 67 title winning teams. And then the main man against Benfica at Wembley in 1968 as United became the first English club to lift the European Cup. A huge, huge figure in football and a very sad day. But he led a great life, a fascinating life. 86 years old, a very full life. And it's been emotional but pretty wonderful to see the tributes coming in from far and wide. I saw a minute silence at FC Barcelona yesterday. Had an Argentinian friend get in touch with me, talking about how we remembered him in 1968 against Estudiantes. The depth of the feeling and the stories about Sir Bobby Charlton are reflected in his status.
Yeah, for a whole generation of football fans travelling around, Bobby Charlton was the reference point for many people. He was the most famous English player. He made Manchester United famous as well for one reason or another around the world. I mean, when you look at some of the people and the players who've paid their tributes to him, Laurie, Wayne Rooney actually said it as well as anyone. He said, he is Manchester United. When you think of Manchester United, the first three people that spring to mind are Sir Matt Busby, Sir Alex Ferguson, and so Bobby Charlton, simple as that.
Yeah, and I was reminded actually of the occasion when Wayne Rooney broke his goal-scoring record for Manchester United on a cold night in Stoke. I was there working, and Sir Bobby Charlton was there in the stand as well. So that, you know, level of affection and dedication to United sustained, you know, right into his 80s, where he was there to watch his team play and the potential for Wayne Rooney to break his record. I think he felt he needed to acknowledge that, you know, and pass the baton on. And he went into the dressing room afterwards and gave him a presentation as well. So he went in and around the dressing room frequently, you know, in that period. You know, it wasn't like he was you know, distant from the club at all. He lived and breathed it, and I think that's only a sort of sign of how much affection he had for the club, given what he'd been through. I think Michael Walker's obituary in the Athletic today, if you read it, I'd be surprised if you're able to get through it without having a tear in the eye. I welled up reading it just because of the depth of emotion and history that is associated with Sir Bobby Charlton. I mean, obviously he talks about, you know, the Munich air disaster in the obituary, and there's a line in it from Sir Bobby Charlton's autobiography which reads, "Sometimes it engulfs me with terrible regret and sadness and guilt that I walked away and found so much." And I think, as Andy's touched on, that must stay with you for such a long time, you know, for your whole life. And that's perhaps, for me, the sadness. I never saw Bobby Charlton play. I've seen the YouTube highlights. I mean, some of his goals, I mean, how he hits it that hard when it's like this, you know, sodden leather ball on this sort of quagmire of a pitch, like incredible talent on, off both feet, left and right. I never watched him play, but he has that link to United's origins, really, to, you know, that history and the standards that he needed to aspire towards to make United a great club, obviously with the support of Sir Matt Busby and other players, great players. But I think he, more than anybody, personified that struggle and that never say die attitude. And I mean, my dad texted me after the news emerged yesterday, and he just said he was the reason why I supported United. You know, hero of many boys my age for England 66. I love seeing the blockbuster goals he scored from 25 yards, and I fell in love as an 8-year-old for the 68 final. And so I sort of owe my United allegiance to Sir Bobby Charlton, really, because it's my dad, and, you know, then this job, you know, is owed to that as well. So it kind of, all that sort of linkage and history is kind of associated with him for me. Never met him. I was once getting a bit of a rollicking from a Premier League manager at a game, and after a game rather, in a stairwell of the stadium, and Sir Bobby Charlton walked past, and he kind of broke off from giving me the finger jabbing and went, "Hello, Sir Bobby." He had to kind of pay his respects in that way.
Couldn't do it in his presence. No, there looking no. at him. He needed to behave better than that.
Well, yeah. Exactly that. I mean, it was Paul Lambert, to be honest, Aston Villa versus United, and it was a 1-1 draw, and it was 2014. Again, so he's going to these matches, you know, well into his later years, and I just think that just shows the joy that he must have for the club and for the sport.
Andy, you must have met him loads down the years. Your paths must have crossed many times.
I don't think he'd remember it, but I interviewed him plenty of times. Well, first of all, as a supporter on a plane to Lisbon for Eusebio's 50th birthday in 1992, it was Eric Cantona's first game. Me and my mates just booked a flight. This was in the days before Budget Airlines, Manchester to Lisbon, and we saw Bobby Charlton was in the business class at the front, and the net went across, and we thought, okay, that's the last we'll see of Bobby Charlton today. But once we'd reached a cruising altitude, the net went back over, and Sir Bobby Charlton appeared and walked down the whole of the plane speaking to all the United fans, which was a bit of a surprise because he was a very reserved private man. He knew who he could trust. Very different personality to George Best, might be an opposite of his. Even within the team, he would act completely differently to some players in comparison with other players. And maybe Munich changed his personality. I'm sure it did. And yet his best friend for a long time was Maurice Setters, who was a real party-going, very popular with the ladies, Bobby's best man. He became a United director, a statesman in the club. I spoke yesterday to a director of Schalke 04, the German Giants, and he said, we visited in 2011 for the Champions League semi-final, and his strongest memory was Bobby Charlton. And he wasn't just ringing me to tell me that after he died, he told me that the first time he ever met me. So there is this cliche of, you know, people being found in the rainforest in deepest South America, Africa, and the only English words they can say are Bobby Charlton. But it is rooted in the truth because he was so good, and he did it for his country as well. A wonderful, wonderful footballer. But there's stuff which I've been soaking it all in today, and I've spoke to so many people over the years about him that there's a few little nuggets of information that I don't think people know in the mainstream. He loved a swig of whiskey before every Manchester United game. He said it helped him with his breathing.
Really? Is this playing or watching?
Playing.
Right.
And Laurie used the word breathing before, right? One thing Bobby Charlton said was, to him, playing football well was as natural as breathing. I mean, imagine having that talent that it was just so easy, that you're so consistent and so good. And of course it helped that he had a wonderful manager and world-class players all around him. I spoke to Brian Kidd yesterday, who was crying down the phone. He just said, I idolised him, I looked up to him, but he was very demanding of him. He wasn't vocal. He led by example. You just watch him and think, well, A, I'm not going to emulate that because I'm never going to get to that level, but at least I'm going to try to get to the level that I can play in the same team as him. Kidd said he used to glide across the grass. He was a beautiful player, balletic even. It's lovely hearing all of these stories and anecdotes about his wonderful life.
I love the idea that a new generation of fans will be introduced now to Bobby Charlton as well. Obviously, news of his passing is extremely sad, but I think the legacy is important, and that kids now, or Manchester United fans, newer fans, whatever age they are, will now learn about him and what he stood for. We know about Munich, obviously. We've heard the stories down the years. We've heard Sir Bobby himself talk about it, about the recovery of Manchester United from that point as well. In fact, I was reading a tweet yesterday that said that he actually made his England debut just 2 months on from that crash. I mean, what he went through is just unimaginable. And then his role in leading Manchester United forward. Obviously, there was the manager, the statesman, that was Sir Matt Busby, and he had to recover in hospital, and his assistant Jimmy Murphy led the team, but Sir Bobby played his part, and United fans should know all about that, know about what he did, what he stood for, and not just know about the statue that's outside.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you say, I think this will bring it to a wider audience again. You know, I've been myself delving into different aspects of his life just because of this, you know, which I know it shouldn't really take their passing to do that, but sometimes there needs to be a kind of a trigger for it. And I mean, you know, United have opened a book of condolence at Old Trafford. It's been signed by more than 1,000 fans already, which I think is a testament to the depth and spread of feeling in the local area. And I wouldn't be surprised if people come, you know, from further afield. You know, the book will be open, I think, until Friday. Obviously, there's a game on Tuesday night. You can't sign it then, but, you know, that might be another reason for people to at least stay over and pay their respects. Yeah, some of the bits that I've kind of been remembering. Yeah, you're talking about the next generation as well. And this is why it's sort of so crucial to have figures like this at United. And I know he's kind of peerless in that regard, but Rio Ferdinand in 2008 for the Champions League final, before we went up, he was, you know, a bit of a mess, he says. And it was Sir Bobby Charlton that took him aside and said, you know, realise that there's only been, you know, a couple of people that have lifted this trophy as captains of Manchester United. This is what it means. And kind of just took that moment to make him realise the kind of significance of it all. And from somebody with his experience, and he touched on the fact that it basically, you know, boys had lost their lives in pursuit of this trophy. You know, Munich was because United, Sir Matt Busby wanted to be intrepid, wanted to challenge themselves, and thought that football as a global sport, you know, deserved a European competition where the best faced the best. And obviously that ended in tragedy in 1958, but it was from that point that then United were then in pursuit of it until 1968. And I think Sir Bobby Charlton in that game obviously felt that that was kind of the end of that journey, that cycle, and that it had been a worthwhile enterprise. And he kind of wanted to remind Rio Ferdinand in that moment in Moscow, 50 years on from Munich, of the significance of it. And also there's that moment, wasn't there, where, you know, they're giving out the medals. I think it's Michel Platini, and Peter Kenyon's gone up for Chelsea, you know, which is fine. He's an executive, but nobody with that depth of football heritage, and he takes the medal around his neck, and Sir Bobby Charlton doesn't. You know, he kind of says, no, this is for the current crop. So obviously he's there, but he's not wanting to take the limelight. And also I kind of came across another clip of him speaking after 99, when he's he's just remembering being there in the stadium in the Nou Camp, and obviously that was Sir Matt Busby's birthday, and you know, describing the goals, and he just said it was paradise. Football won't get better than this. And you just that you can't get away from that being at the core of anybody who loves, you know, sport and football, really, that there's these joyous moments, and he clearly personified that until the very end.
And then I sat back and I tried to keep myself cool, but while I was actually thinking, keep cool, we went and we got a corner. David Beckham knocks the ball across, Teddy Sheringham helps it on, and Gunnar Solskjaer knocks the ball into the net. And as the ball hits the net, for me it was as though the world stood still. I thought, this is what paradise is all about. It's got to be. And I honestly do not remember what I did for about 5 minutes. I went up to my wife and my daughter, my son-in-law were up there. I dashed up to them, I dashed back, and suddenly the world was great again. And I thought, well, there is nothing ever going to be better than this.
Someone who knew him once said to me that he was only comfortable with certain people, Bobby Charlton. And when you saw him with his mates, people like Maurice Setter, Shea Brennan, Nobby Styles, he was a completely different person, funny, happy-go-lucky. And he was a bit of a practical joker on the sly. What he'd do, he'd go to the cinema with his wife, and even if the film was terrible, he'd go into training the next day and lie and said, one of the greatest films I've ever seen. So you had all these world-class footballers then going to the cinema in Manchester, wasting 2 or 3 hours, and then coming in the next day to say that they'd been told off by the wives for taking them to see a terrible film. Now, the way they got Bobby Charlton back was depriving him of a cream cake. He loved cream cakes. Now, none of the other players did, because after all, they were professional athletes. So how on earth did he become one of the best players, maybe even the greatest ever English player, having a nip of whiskey before a game and having a strong penchant for cream cakes?
I guess that's the secret behind the solid shot that Laurie was talking about. I mean, I remember going to the Bobby Charlton soccer school when I was a kid, and one of the tests that they did at the end of the week to rank everyone was how hard your shot was. It was the first time and only time I think I've ever hit a shot that's been recorded as to how quick it was. It was such a key component of his game, wasn't it? So perhaps I just needed a swig of whiskey and a cream cake at the age of 7 or 8 when I was going there.
How hard was your shot?
I don't remember. Not as hard as Bobby. I think every single time someone shot, I think the feedback was, yeah, not as hard as Bobby, not as hard as Bobby.
Then Bobby Charlton soccer schools, which were actually other sports as well, were a real big deal in my childhood in Manchester.
Same, yeah.
And even though you had to pay to go on them, you did think it was like a stepping stone to basically being the captain of Manchester United. I think the only person who came close to that was David Beckham, because he was one of them. But we'd go along to Fallowfield and...
By the way, it's not just our childhood. When I went, there was people from all around the world on those schools. You know, like you were saying before, his name went everywhere. But I think the influence post-game with the soccer schools, the foundation, perhaps more importantly as well. You know, it wasn't just us. It was international football, well, dreamers, shall we call them, like us.
And he didn't just put his name to it. He did actually turn up and say... You know, Andy, I've just seen you beat 7 or 8 men there. It was a fantastic run, but you've got to be putting in the top corner, is what he never said to me.
I'm just thinking, should we do a tribute then on Tuesday night before the Copenhagen game? Swig of whiskey and a cream cake each.
Yeah, I like it.
It could become a new tradition, that. We should do that before every pod recording.
Might make them better.
Well, something needs to, certainly. I mean, on Bobby Charlton then, we've talked a lot, Andy, about his role on the pitch for Manchester United and his influence on people, but... In his role as a director, I mean, he was a director for nearly 40 years of the club. How will he be remembered in that sense?
He did a difficult job. And when most Manchester United fans were calling for Sir Alex Ferguson to be sacked, Sir Bobby Charlton stuck by Sir Alex Ferguson. And that wasn't a popular thing to do at the time, because he could see the work that he was doing behind the scenes. He was also very supportive of the Glazers, which is his opinion, but it's not an opinion which would tally with what most Manchester United fans would think, in my experience. I think the fact that the main stand was named after him was a fitting honour. I know that meant a huge amount to him. And if we're going to move it forward, I think that main stand should be improved and keep his name. You know, it's the one part of Old Trafford which does need doing. And it could be a good time to do it. I think it would be remembered quite rightly as one of the greatest, if not the greatest ever, Manchester United footballer.
Yes, absolutely. I need to say at this point as well, the club have published an article on their website with instructions of how you can pay your respects to Sir Bobby. We'll add a link to that in our show notes. And also, Bobby and his brother Jack Charlton lived with dementia later on in their lives before they passed away. And Bobby's wife, Lady Norma, hoped that his diagnosis could raise awareness of the disease to help fund research into treatment and hopefully find a cure as well. If you want to help with that, you may wish to consider a donation to the Alzheimer's Society or to Alzheimer's Disease International, and we'll also add those links to our show notes as well.
Well, the crowd have really decided that victory is theirs, haven't they? Aston, Charlton, another! He's got another! 9 minutes gone! And this must be it now! Oh, what football this is by United! With only seconds left, both linesmen have given the signal that it's all over. We don't even look at Georgie Best, we look at the referee. To receive the trophy, everybody wants to shout now, well done Bobby Charlton, well done Manchester United.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Okay, well, of course, there was a lovely tribute from Manchester United to Sir Bobby Charlton ahead of the victory at Sheffield United. Perhaps that was the best tribute they could pay them. Scott McTominay obviously scored again. He dedicated his goal to Sir Bobby. They made hard work of it, Laurie, didn't they, in a way? But the win is a win again.
Yeah, and I suppose we're talking about, you know, 20, 25-yard screamers, and Diogo Dalot, you know, curled one in from that kind of range. I think Charlton maybe used to hit it a bit harder, but it was well placed. Maybe, you know, Fotheringham could have got more of a hand to it. He sort of, you know, got there. But I think it was a really nice strike from Dalot. And I suppose at least that's one aspect that will please Erik ten Hag. And he said this sort of afterwards. He didn't spare them from the first half display, which Sheffield United with a better team for the majority of it. But at least in the second half, you saw more of that controlled possession in the final third, where there was passes being picked and a kind of a sort of design to break down Sheffield United rather than kind of the chaos that had ensued in the first half. I thought Amrabat got on the ball more in the final third. Eriksen was important to that. You had Garnacho with that spark down the left, and obviously it was Lindelof that was able to put the pass to Dalot, but he got that space because Sheffield United were focusing on other areas of the pitch to try and, you know, stop United. So he was able to have a bit of time on the ball and pick his spot. So yeah, a victory yet again, another grind though. Every single win for United this season in the Premier League has been hard, and you could argue, you know, Sheffield United, I mean, I think they actually had better XG than United, which, okay, how much stock you put in that for an individual game, I don't know, but I was surprised at that, because I actually thought there were, in the second half, certainly lots of chances. Even if United didn't actually have the shot in the end, there were lots of opportunities where they should have done better really with it. They should have had a clear one-on-one, and I think I texted you, didn't I? We were exchanging messages during the game, and you were saying, I don't see how United win this. I can see Sheffield United definitely cruising to an easy victory here. Yeah,
exactly,
and I was like, no, No. I said, United will win this. That was sort of early in the second half. Yeah, not the biggest of gambles to make. No, your listeners, he didn't say that, by the way, just to clarify. But you could sort of sense, I mean, being there in the stadium, that atmosphere was certainly something for United to, you know, get to grips with. And they have, you know, they pushed Man City pretty close there. But obviously their previous game at home was an 8-0 defeat to Newcastle United. And you could kind of see how a team would beat them by that scoreline, because once it had their sort of flourishes, their moments in the game, they sat back quite a lot and they were making quite a few mistakes, and it really, United should have won by more.
Wasn't the best again, Andy, was it? Like Laurie was saying in there was bits to pick out. We'll talk about Harry Maguire in a moment, who was great, and he's having a bit of a renaissance as well, which we'll go into. But yeah, just hard work to watch, really, wasn't it? There still doesn't seem to be much joy in this team, really, does there, all round?
I was worried for large parts of the game. The bottom line is Manchester United got 3 points, three big points. But there was very little evidence to show that United are coming out of a bad period with any sort of conviction where you think that the team can go and beat a top side. And that first half was pretty alarming. To go there and win, I expected it. Manchester United are very good at teams lower down. And there's no lower down than a Sheffield United team who haven't won a game. I know Bramall Lane's atmospheric. I know there's that beautiful song about a night out in Sheffield, and it was a night out. And I love that Greasy Chip Butty song. And I respect them greatly as a club. But if Manchester United wouldn't have won there, that would have been a major, major problem, because United have lost too many games so far this season. And you say about Harry, what about the lad next to him, Johnny?
Yeah.
Because he started three games this season and Manchester United have won all three. So if you think there's...
Well, Harry Maguire's made 8 Premier League starts in the last 12 months and Manchester United have won all 8 as well. The pair of them need to play every week, I think.
So let's just... If Johnny carries on playing, well, how many games left? 31. So if you win all 31 and he doesn't get injured...
Is he not already injured?
I was going to say he had a bit of a knock, came off, didn't he, for Varane?
Yeah, but he's got superpowers. He'll just rise like a fish in the Manchester derby at the weekend, head the ball in.
Do you know what that reminds me of? This weirdly just got a flick of this. Porto in 96, 97, when David May was described as rising like a salmon to score that goal.
He did, like Billy the Fish. I say it half in jest. I mean, I think Johnny coming back has been fantastic. He's been there to be called upon because of all the injuries, and he's done really well. I am worried, though, ahead of the Manchester derby next weekend. And if Manchester United could avoid defeat in that, that would be a big improvement on a lot of what we've seen so far. I'm torn between thinking, is what we've seen this season, or is it just an injury-induced slump at the start of the season? Was the home form last season where Manchester United are at under Ten Hag, or was it a misnomer and what we're seeing with, you know, even Wolves dominating more where Manchester United are at? I'm sounding hesitant and doubtful because I am. I think the team scores too few goals away from home. If you look at where the goals are coming from, they're not really coming from the front players.
Not at all.
I'm enjoying watching Rasmus Højlund, but sooner rather than later, he's going to be judged on how many goals he's scoring in the league. And we're seeing the assists. You mentioned Lindelof before, Laurie. It's Maguire, it's McTominay, it's Johnny Evans. The players in the attacking part of Manchester United's team really need to be contributing.
Well, I've got some stats on it, yeah. In terms of the strikers for United this season, 1 goal from Marcus Rashford at Arsenal, 2 assists from Marcus Rashford, maybe even 1 actual assist, I think, in the Premier League, which was against Nottingham Forest. He won a penalty, of course, as well. In terms of defenders, though, Laurie, 2 goals and 5 assists from people who've played in the back line this season, which is ridiculous, really. But, I mean, we could praise that until tomorrow, but we need to look at why the forwards aren't scoring. Rasmus Højlund has missed 6 big chances so far in his Premier League career. And it doesn't feel like he's struggling at all, actually. Quite the opposite. But Andy's right, sooner or later, there is going to be a little bit of scrutiny on that goal tally in the league. Although if he keeps doing stuff like he's been doing in the Champions League, perhaps that'll save him.
Well, that's it. I think because it was so thrilling against Galatasaray, that's enough for people to go, okay, this guy does have serious quality. He's 20. Really, United should not be playing a 20-year-old who hasn't played in the Premier League before this much to begin with. I mean, you know, he did take him off, and Ten Hag's talking about, you know, integrating him and rotating him as the games go on. But really, you'd want to sign a 20-year-old with his experience and be able to bed them in, rotate properly. But when he brings on Anthony Martial, okay, yeah, there's some nice sort of little interplay, I suppose, from him. But you're not really, he's not coming on with any expectation that he's going to change the game and score a goal. Whereas if you had an established centre forward alongside Højlund, you could more easily, you know, take him out of the firing line if he felt like he needed to. But I agree with you that actually the time that he's played, he's looked sharp, he's looked good. He just hasn't, in the Premier League yet, got that finishing touch, although I suppose he did against Brighton when the ball didn't go out. But but against Sheffield United, I think he actually should have been sharper to the Marcus Rashford ball across the centre, because you could see that developing from the position up in the press box at Bramall Lane, where Anthony actually did pretty well, I thought, to kind of cut inside and whip the cross over. And you could see that that's what Rashford was going to do, so he just didn't quite get there. Also, you know, nice feet for the Rashford deflected shot where he brings, I think it's a really good save from the goalkeeper. I'm not sure what more Højlund could have done. And then obviously there's that slightly odd situation in the second half where Rashford, he just shoot, you know, when Fodderingham, I think, again has made a mistake, and he gives it to Højlund, it's like behind him, and then Rashford's sort of asking for the ball in return, but Hoyland's had the shot by this point. But so that was a slightly odd, I wouldn't really put that one on him, saying, you know, he should have converted that chance, but that might well be, I don't know if that counts as a big chance. I need to sort of check with Opta which six chances it is that he's missed. But I mean, I saw that list because you sent again, you were brilliant with the data this weekend, Ian. You're like, you were sending me this stuff during the game, weren't you, about United's defenders and attackers. I was like, perfect for my piece, thank you, saving me some work. But Erling Haaland's top of that list, isn't he, with 9 big chances missed. So you sort of think, well, you know, at least he's getting in these situations, and it should come.
It doesn't feel like Højlund's missed sitters either. You know, I know that that is big chances, but a big chance, you know, doesn't have to be an open goal as such.
No.
I'm struggling to think of like really glaring misses that he's made.
He's not had any Wout Weghorst moments, has he?
It doesn't feel like it, does it? Let's talk about someone else, because I don't want to put too much scrutiny on the young man who needs to lead our hopes into the Champions League crucial game against Copenhagen, his old team, which we'll talk about in a minute, and also the Manchester derby at the weekend. Let's talk about Harry Maguire. Laurie, you've done a piece on him, which is on The Athletic now, that people can go and read. But Andy, more like it from Maguire. Is this him finally emerging from all the sort of crap that he's had to go through over the last sort of 12 months or so?
Yes and no. I said a few times on this pod that he needs to have very good games against very good teams, and I don't think you can say Sheffield United are one of them. Going back to his hometown, playing against his former club, basically doing nothing wrong, getting the man of the match awarded to him is absolutely a good thing for him. But someone of his calibre, price, etc., will be judged how he does in the biggest games. And when he went on international duty, as has often happens, there was noise about his future. I think he just wants to be playing more regularly, and the injuries to other players will be a big factor in that. But he's had decent games, and I think he deserves the credit which he's been getting. If he has a decent game against Manchester City, ask me again that question, because that will take it up a notch. That's what he really needs before a lot of the people who've been on to Maguire go, you know what, I've got to hold my hands up here.
Yeah, it's going to take a little bit more, isn't it? Laurie, you've written in your piece that you think he's going to start the derby.
I mean, I just don't see... I mean, obviously, there's the Copenhagen game in the middle of that, so I guess that could change things a little bit. But Martinez isn't coming back. Johnny Evans went off with a bit of an injury, and you'd sort of think, even in that space, I know he's got 100% record, Andy, and he should start every game that he is fit just to preserve that. But if Maguire's fit, you'd think that he still starts, and I suppose him and Varane maybe. It would be really interesting if you've got Evans, Varane and Maguire all fit, if Ten Hag really thinks that Evans is a better left-sided centre-half than Harry Maguire.
Is Lindelof not going to come back into consideration if Reguilon's fit as well?
True, yeah. Sorry, I suppose there is that as well. But I mean, is Reguilon... I suppose you'd have to think Reguilon must start if he's fit, but I suppose it's
he's
just
an actual
question
left
mark,
back, which might help. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and there was moment. I mean, I think Lindelof's done an all right job. I mean, in against Sheffield United, he was dropping into midfield. So, like, if you have it as that inverted fullback, then it's kind of not as essential that he is a natural left back. But there was a couple of moments where you could tell a left footer would have been better in certain situations. He kind of had to cut back and the momentum went. So yeah, Reguilon on those overlapping runs, like we saw against Bayern Munich, would be an improvement, you'd think.
Yeah.
But I just think that Maguire, I don't know, I just think that maybe this is at a point where Ten Hag goes, okay, let's see if you've got it, Harry, you know, because he's obviously challenged him to step up at different points. Clearly, he could have gone in the summer. You know, if they'd agreed terms with West Ham, you know, United would have sold him, Ten Hag would have sold him. But this was, I asked him after the game about Maguire, and it was genuine. You know, I know you get managers that will say nice things about players, but he's kind of been saying those things, Ten Hag, previously about, okay, well, if, you know, he needs to challenge himself and he needs to do these things. After the game against Sheffield United, he actually said, no, I was really pleased with how proactive he was. And I sensed that. And maybe it was because he was at Bramall Lane, you know, a familiar setting. He got applauded by the Sheffield United fans at the start of the game. I remember being there in the FA Youth Cup final in 2011 when he was playing for Sheffield United against, you know, United and Paul Pogba and Jesse Lingard. So this is a place that he obviously feels comfortable in. And I think he was, you know, he seemed to have the metal, you know, between his teeth, and he was stepping forward, you know, making these tackles. The passing, I thought, was really good, you know, 76 passes completed, by far the most by a United player. And I know that that can be sometimes like a 5 yard pass sideways, so I'm not sort of
hang on. 13 successful long passes, which was the most in the Premier League on Saturday, so they weren't all 5 yard balls to the side of him.
And there was one, you know, for example, there's one to my mind into Anthony. Anthony dropped and he kind of fired it through the lines, and that just got United into, you know, their territory. There was another really nice ball out to Rashford that actually bounced off the surface and went over Rashford's head, but that would have been a nice pass if it had actually, it was maybe Rashford needed to come forward a little bit, I don't know, but I just thought that he seemed confident, and that's obviously been the big issue with Maguire throughout all of this, which is obviously difficult to get when you get in, you know, sort of ironic jeers from home fans on pre-season tours and applauded onto the pitch by, you know, Arsenal fans and Crystal Palace fans who sung his name, and, you know, so he's had a lot of it. And I mean, I think some of it, he kind of opens himself up a little bit. You know, Andy, you touched on it where international break, he gives an interview and he sort of talks about his ridiculously high record for United under Ten Hag. And I kind of, people can scoff at that because it's, you know, the list of clubs that he's talking about, you expect United to be, you know, so that those 8 consecutive wins when he started, you know, all those games you'd hope. I think Aston Villa at home is the only one where you're like, okay, that's a good, but it's no big six, it's no away game in a, you know, a really pivotal game. And the match that started that all off was the Brentford 4-0. That was the last match he started that United didn't win, which is obviously the match that made Ten Hag think, I need to change this. But I still think in that regard, in terms of Maguire saying that himself, you know, he has to back himself. If he's getting, you know, sort of battered from all sides, fair enough for him to come out and say, actually, if you look at this, and I'm not as bad as people are making out. And I think that was just a performance. He's not turned the corner, because as Andy said, you've got to wait until it's in a big game. But I think that, you know, it just was a reminder that actually he's a pretty good footballer.
Yeah, if you want to know how backed you are, Harry Maguire, go and read Laurie's piece on The Athletic. It's a lovely take on the performance at Bramall Lane.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu.
I'm going to get straight into Copenhagen and just do a quick preview to that as well, because it's a huge game for United, Andy, isn't it? Considering, you know, the performances and results in Europe so far, it's a must-win in that respect. But it's going to be a very emotional night as well for Old Trafford, paying its respects to Sir Bobby Charlton. It's going to be a very poignant occasion.
Absolutely, it will. And we spoke a lot about Sir Bobby. And I remember when Sir Matt died, it was one of the most memorable, momentous games or occasions at Old Trafford in recent history, and I'm sure Tuesday will be similar. As for the game, not only is that a must win, the away leg's a must win as well.
Yeah.
Manchester United really need 6 points from them next two games against possibly the biggest club in Scandinavia, certainly in Denmark with respect to Brøndby. I know that Manchester United consider FC Copenhagen to be a proper side. Their Champions League form is very good at home. It's patchy away. They've got excellent support, really loud, vociferous. I know a few of them, really well organised. And I think they might surprise a few people at Old Trafford. So Old Trafford's got to be up for it as well, because if not, you're going to have a situation which was found in recent years when PSG came, when St Etienne came, where the home fans just get completely outsung. So the fans have got to do their bit. I was supposed to interview the left back, Birger Meling, the Norwegian, today. Unfortunately for him, he went off on Saturday after 35 minutes, and it looks like he's going to miss both of those games against Manchester United. So it's a shame for him, but Copenhagen carrying injuries is obviously something which now affects them as well as Manchester United. If you want two words from me on both of the games, it's must win. And I said exactly the same before Galatasaray. If you don't win this one, Manchester United are going out of the Champions League, and that will be an absolute shambles, three straight defeats.
Yeah, it certainly would. I mean, it's only the second time FC Copenhagen will have ever visited Old Trafford, Laurie. I was speaking to some of the Danish reporters at Anfield, because I worked the Merseyside derby at the weekend, and they described this game as the biggest in a decade for FC Copenhagen. So that's the sort of energy that United are going to have to match.
Yeah, and I mean, I just hope that the Tickenden situation, I was just reminded of that when Andy was saying about United fans having to turn up. I was like, please don't let there be thousands of Copenhagen fans in the home section as there was against Galatasaray.
The difference this time is those Copenhagen fans will probably have Manchester United as their second team, so they'll probably be happy either way.
Half and half scarves doing a roaring trade. But, you know, and all credit to them. If it's the biggest game in 10 years, you want a memento, don't you? But yeah, I mean, they've looked like, you know, decent in both their matches, right? Like they took a 2-0 lead over in Istanbul, and they went ahead against Bayern Munich. So they've obviously got sort of a good ability behind them. Whether that's enough to beat United, I mean, yeah, United have struggled against basically all opposition this season, haven't they? So it could be another edgy occasion. I'm interested to see if Rasmus Højlund's brothers feature.
He's going to have a point to prove feature as well, Rasmus Højlund, isn't he? Surely, after being rejected the way he was by Copenhagen and sold on. I mean,
quite a tasty story, that one, isn't it? We've actually got a piece on that coming up. Matt Critchley, my colleague, has got some good detail on that. So keep your eyes peeled for that one, because it's a mad story, isn't it? Copenhagen let this kid go, who's been in their academy the whole time, basically. Goes to Sturm Graz for like, what is it, a couple of million euros, something like that?
Peanuts in modern terms, really.
Peanuts.
Yeah.
And within, you know, three games, I was speaking to someone who watched him at Sturm Graz, and he said, I was just watching this guy thinking, how have Copenhagen let him go? I know it wasn't, it was basically, they sort of felt that he wasn't right for them. Certainly he felt he was, and I think they weren't shy about saying that. So there was maybe a bit of a clash of personalities there. But then within, you know, 18 months, 2 years, he's costing 85 million euro and he's playing for Manchester United. So it's a wild story.
Going to be fascinating to see him in action, Andy, isn't it? Just to see how he is and dealing with this sort of emotion around the game.
Yeah, it's wonderful that football throws up these stories as well, and I'm really looking forward to
it. Especially against his brother, potentially, as well,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, more so because it is now a big game. When the group was drawn, it looked like a win for Manchester United, and it still might be, but the first two results mean it's huge. I interviewed one of Copenhagen's main fans, and I was expecting him to say, can't wait to visit Manchester United, one of the greatest clubs in the world, etc., etc. And he actually said, I think Manchester's an awful city. I wish we were going somewhere else. I'm like, oh, wait a minute, mate. Here. And, you know, Manchester United aren't quite what they were. We wanted a bigger club. I'm like, hold your horses. Come on. But I think maybe speaking for himself. We did play against Copenhagen in Cologne behind closed doors a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And we've also played another Champions League game there as well, where United have never won over there. But that game in Copenhagen, so much has changed since then. Ståle Solbakken their longtime manager. He's the man who was their Sir Matt Busby, their Alex Ferguson. He's now managing the Norwegian national team, but they still have remained the preeminent force in Danish football. It isn't one of the strongest leagues in Europe, but it is a country which produces top footballers and is a very successful football club. The fans will be the one thing I'd watch out for. They're surprisingly good.
Okay, well, we've got that to look forward to as well. We'll be back on Thursday. We're going to leave it there for Talk of the Devils today, but thank you very much for listening. Laurie, thank you as well. Andy, thank you to you too. If you want to get in touch with the podcast, remember you can always do that. Just email devilspod@theathletic.com. But yeah, we look ahead to Tuesday and what's going to be a very emotional night at Old Trafford. See you on the next one. Bye-bye.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.